Today is January 5th, 2016. This is William Cook with the National Trust for Historic Preservation, here to conduct an oral history interview with Gabriel Taussig, an attorney who worked for a number of years in the law department of the New York City government for nearly four decades. We are conducting the interview at the New York Preservation Archive Project's headquarters at the Kress Foundation in New York City. Gabe, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
I'm looking forward to our conversation. When did you join the law department, Gabe?
In 1974.
Okay. And could you tell me a little bit about your work in the law department and how your career progressed in it?
I was, from the very beginning, assigned to a division whose name changed while I was there, but whose function was to represent the city, its agencies, and employees in connection with litigation concerning the city's regulatory activities. Mm-hmm. And that ran the whole gamut from parking tickets to licensing to landmarks, the spectrum of land use issues, building department, fire department, and the like. I started off as a staff attorney, and over the years worked my way up the ranks, as it were, to becoming chief of the division. When I left it, it was the administrative law division. Most of my time there, it was known as the administrative law division.
Okay. And you retired when?
In October of 2013.
Okay. Thank you. A lot of people aren't aware of this, but New York City has not only one of the largest law divisions or law departments in the country in terms of a municipality, but it's also one of the oldest.
Yes, in fact.
Or is the oldest, perhaps.
I suspect it might be. I don't know that, but there are several histories that have been written that are quite fascinating.
Yeah.
And the kind of parallel the history of the city and the law department.
Yeah. So just to be sure, I've gotten the range of topic areas that you covered during your time in the administrative law division. That would include landmarking, which you mentioned, land use, housing, public health, public safety, and licensing. Any other categories that
In recent years, pensions.
Okay.
In prior years, civil rights cases concerning, not in recent past years, but earlier civil rights cases involving conduct of police officers and correction officers and the like. I think that's environmental issues too. The office now, and for quite a few years, has had an environmental litigation division, but prior to the creation of that division, we did also some environmental related cases. Yeah.
So it's your practice has included a wide breadth of issues.
Indeed.
Yeah. Could you like to turn for a moment to a little bit about your biographical background?
Sure.
If you could share with me where you were born and how you came to be in New York City.
I was born in Haifa, Israel. I came here with my family at the age of seven. My parents are both survivors of the Holocaust. My father's family immigrated here, and my mother's family to then Palestine, and then Israel. And we came here to visit my father's family, and that visit extended a few years. We stayed here.
Yeah.
So I was basically educated in the New York City public school system, went to Queens College of the City University of New York, Brooklyn Law School, and then to my work at the law department.
Okay. And where did you grow up? In which neighborhood?
Not too far away from where I live right now, in Queens, in the Kew Gardens areas of Queens.
Yeah, it's a beautiful neighborhood. I've had the pleasure of visiting it a couple of times on my own. What were some elements of it that you like or remember most fondly?
The word wasn't in vogue then, but it was a very diverse place to live. My best friend was Asian. We played with people of Italian heritage, Irish heritage, and weren't aware of that fact.
Yeah.
My childhood had idyllic moments. I recall summers where we would bicycle to a structure that no longer exists. It was called the Aquacade, mm-hmm. which was part of the 39 World's Fair and turned into a public swimming pool, and we would go swimming every summer morning. As I said, bicycling down there, and you know, Tom Sawyerish qualities to that.
Yeah.
I remember the 64 World's Fair again. It was pretty close by, and
yeah.
you know, it was kind of stood out in my memory in that regard.
Yeah.
School was always exciting. Yeah. We kind of said I went to local schools, attended Jamaica High School, which was an exceptionally fine school when we were there, when I was there, and had a great experience there.
Yeah. What do you remember, or what was most striking about the built environment to you and Kew Gardens?
I don't know that as a child that that was something that particularly struck me. what I remember then, and kind of I'm aware of now because I pass it quite frequently, and because I had some friends who lived there, was Parkway Village,
mm-hmm.
Which was a community, post-war community, that was essentially built for United Nations employees. and it had vestiges of that still when I was older. I mean, it was not, didn't live that closely to it, but when I got a little older, would be there quite a bit, and it was a... It struck me because it was the only kind of cohesive community in that respect that that I knew.
Yeah. When do you recall or is there a time? Do you remember a time where you were first impressed by the architecture of a building, or do you have a favorite building or two or three in New York City?
I think as a child, I was more impressed by the skyline, as it were, going to and from Queens. Those vistas always struck me, especially at night.
Yeah.
But otherwise, in terms of actual buildings, I guess United Nations, Empire State, those buildings that kind of stand out in that respect. While in law school, I had an internship with the New York State Attorney General at the time, in the summer that they moved to the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
So I was one of the first occupants of that, and that whole experience, that building, impressed me. Not necessarily to the positive, but it was, I was a little old at the time, of course, too, but something that pretty much stands out in my memory.
Yeah. What drew you to law? I know that's a broad question, but how did you end up in law as a career path?
I can't think of a definitive moment. It was a function of my general interest of what we used to call current events and the social studies, as it were. And that's what I gravitated to throughout my educational career, and law seemed to be a natural extension of that.
Mm-hmm. What if I were to ask the same question about historic preservation?
It found me. I didn't look at it. Same. I was assigned to a division where that work was being done, and I started doing it, and as I was doing it, it became, you know, more and more of an interest.
Yeah. We'll have a chance during the interview to talk about some of the cases that you were involved in. Do you happen to recall which one was your first, sort of one that stands out?
Quite honestly, I don't know that I handled on my own an individual case from soup to nuts. For the most part, I supervised and oversaw the litigation, and I was also frequently involved in matters that didn't go to litigation but were the subject of interaction and counseling between our office and the commission, and perhaps even sometimes City Hall. But no one case had my name on it exclusively.
And I'm asking you to think way back, and it's fine if you don't remember, but do you recall your first preservation case, whether you handled it or not as an attorney or worked on a preservation case?
I actually thought about that before, and I don't. I really don't.
That's fine. Fair enough. With whom did you work on preservation law-related cases? I'm sure there were a number of attorneys. Are there any?
Well, you met one of them. Okay. Well, you met two of them, in fact, and I worked with them in different capacities. Virginia Waters, who was one of the attorneys in my division from day one, expressed an interest in these cases, and she excelled in them, and we tried to accommodate them. You know, we from a philosophical point of view, we tried to, if you will, spread the wealth so that other people had the opportunity to handle cases, and Virginia didn't handle all of them, but she probably handled some of the more significant, challenging ones. So Virginia's one. Len Kerner, who was my direct supervisor and also the head of the appeals division, was a person we regularly interacted with in both strategies and appellate-related issues that came up. Of course, there was Dorothy Minor at the Landmarks Commission, who I'm sure, whose name I'm sure has come up frequently in your conversations. But she was the only attorney at the commission and the go-to person, and rather unique in many respects, not the least of which was her detailed involvement in the cases and the matters that we had to deal with.
Sounds like a good team.
Indeed.
A legal dream team for preservation law.
Another person who comes to mind is Robin Binder, who, when I retired, and is now retired too, was my deputy. But she was involved in several significant landmark cases while law.
Is Robin still practicing law?
She is retired. I haven't, well, I, as far as I know, not now. She was contemplating it. I don't know if she actually, you know, kind of. And I don't know what became of that, so I'm not absolutely sure.
Do you know if she's still in the New York area?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's out on the island.
On Long Island.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
There are several islands around here.
I come from an area of a lot of islands.
So, indeed.
I just thought I'd double check. Kind of just kind of probing some of your experience with historic places. Do you remember visiting an historic site as a child, or is there one that, that stands out, whether it's a house museum or a landmark building, baseball stadium?
Well, clearly, over the years, we visited the cultural institutions of the city, which would have included, which did include, Museum of Natural History, Metropolitan Museum of Art. Guggenheim stands out significantly.
Being your parents and
yes,
family.
As a family, but in later years too. But yes, talk about growing up. Yes.
Yeah.
I did not venture out on my own as a young child to Manhattan. But in terms of Queens, and I'm drawing a blank on the name, but there is Colonial House in Jamaica, which I recall was in proximity to my high school. I'm just drawing a blank on the name right now, but I do recall being there. In Flushing, there was the Bound House, and which functioned, I believe, as a museum at the time, too. another structure, which I may be looking at more from the past, from now back to the past, was the Flushing Town Hall. But, you know, I do remember that structure standing out and in its environment.
Do you consider yourself a preservationist? There's no right or wrong answer.
There
are a lot of ways to define that.
I suppose so, but I take that. I don't want to oversell that.
Sure.
Because, and it's funny, because that it was a conversation, one of the first conversations I had with Dorothy Minor.
Yeah.
Because, you know, early dealings, I had the sense that she did not necessarily feel that I was sufficiently committed to the cause, as it were.
Mm-hmm. And to be clear, she was counsel to the Landmarks Commission.
Yes, yes. And what I tried to convey to her, and I think I did, was that I am, if the word is sympathetic, to the work of the commission, while at the same time trying to keep an open mind so that I could properly serve the role of a counselor, so that I could assess the situation, not necessarily with achieving a goal, but with the view of making sure that whatever goal they identify is a lawful one.
Yeah.
They achieve in a lawful manner. So, as I said, I'm sympathetic to it while trying to keep an open mind.
Of course. As you would as a professional, legal professional.
Right. And I, quite honestly, I think that predominated my thinking in my interactions. And once we had that conversation, we were fine. Mm-hmm. And we had a great relationship.
Yeah. Have you ever been a member of any preservation organizations?
In my job, I joined nothing.
Right.
And just in the with the view in mind that I did not want to have any conflicts.
Of course.
So, you know, I was approached about joining community board and mm-hmm. local civic associations, and I demurred for that reason. It was only until recently, I'm now a trustee of the Queen's Library, that was only after.
Yeah. So in terms of your preservation law work, mm-hmm. That work would have flowed directly from your work as an attorney within the Administrative Law Division.
Exclusively.
Okay. There's a lot of discussion today at preservation conferences about why we preserve, and to the extent that you have an interest or have developed an interest in preservation because of the cases that you've worked on, is there a reason or set of reasons that seem to be the most important to you?
Well, sorry, about 10, maybe 15 years ago now, my wife and I took a trip to Europe. We went to Prague. Mm-hmm. And we took a tour, and it struck me how everything was just amazingly preserved. And having fought the battles that we fight in New York, fought and continue to fight, I discussed it with a tour guide. I said, you know, how have you succeeded in preserving it the way it has, and aren't the owners? And she looked at me like I was crazy. The whole culture, the whole sense of value there assumed that you keep it, you preserve it, and at least as she explained it to me, what I was describing as the tension between the property owners and the municipality mm-hmm. was completely foreign to her. Mm-hmm. And you know, it just changed my thinking a little bit about what it could be and how it could be, and how important it was, because what I was walking through in those tours was amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I felt the same way my first trip to Europe, and that's even growing up in, you know, near Charleston, South Carolina, where for the United States there's a lot preserved in terms of the built environment, but I felt a sense of awe when visiting European cities for the first time as well, and being struck with the amount of history that had been preserved.
But also how the culture accepts it.
Yes.
I don't think we're anywhere near that. You know, mm-hmm. I think the sense of values here are significantly different, so that it's not happening too quickly.
You mentioned that occasionally, or maybe early on in your career, that Dorothy Minor may have had questions about a commitment maybe of the city as a whole to preservation values. Was she instrumental in helping to educate lawyers within?
She was crucial.
She
was crucial to it. I mean, she was completely committed to the commission, its work, to preservation. She immersed herself in the cases. I mean, quite honestly, she was involved in the case to the point that some lawyers pushed back because they felt that she was too involved. I think she was vital to the attorney's ability to understand the law as well as the specifics of or the merits of a particular landmark commission action. I couldn't say too much about that.
Yeah, sure. And I've always thought that a powerful feature of New York's preservation program is that the commission has a council. And I know that even though Dorothy Minor is no longer there, that Mark Silberman has continued in that role.
Absolutely.
And imagine that it's great value to the city's Office of Corporation Counsel to have that type of expertise.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's as we started off, the attorneys in the division handle a large spectrum of matters. And while they are very good litigants, by definition, their familiarity with the substantive aspects of some of the cases that they handle, some of the stuff they've done before and they know and they're experts in those, but some of the stuff they meet for the first time, and there are not that many landmarks cases. It's not the commission, in the scheme of things, does not generate that many cases. So it's important to have someone available to not only facilitate a matter, but basically walk them through the dynamics of the individual decision being challenged.
Do you have any thoughts on why there are not many challenges to commission decisions? I think sometimes there's a sense that commission decisions are challenged frequently, but
it is my understanding that in recent years, in any event, the commission has been very careful to work in such a way that they cooperate, they get the cooperation of the property owner. And that doesn't eliminate, but it diminishes challenges from the property owner. And indeed, I think, again, the numbers are not great. So there was a period of time that we were probably seeing more challenges from the preservation community, if you will. And perhaps it was that philosophy of the commission that engendered some of those challenges. I think the commission works thoroughly and carefully in taking its actions, and people don't sue that quickly when that happens. And the volume is not that great in comparison to others.
Yeah, fair enough. I'd like to turn now, Gabe, to some of the preservation cases in which you were involved. And I've done some research on my own.
Okay.
Maybe I can help fill in the blanks.
Please
but
do.
If you were to create help me create a list, are there any that stand out to you. We can explore these cases further.
And I hesitate, in no particular order,
yes,
in terms of either of importance or my assessment of their significance, but one case, and probably just because it lasted so long and was one of the few losses that we had, that was the Rudy case, which I believe went to the Court of Appeals.
Could you spell it for me?
R-U-D-Y. Involving windows on Fifth Avenue near the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where someone changed the windows that went in a way that was without landlord's permission or whatever. The Grand Central, I was not, my involvement, indeed, the division's involvement in with the commission does not go back to the beginning of the commission. Initially, and for a period of years, another division handled those cases, and it was only a few years after I started that decision was made that they were more appropriately in my division. So there were several cases that predate that, including the original Grand Central litigation, and some of the initial, I forgot the church case, some of the church cases. Mm-hmm. But there was Grand Central litigation that Virginia was involved with back in the, I guess, late 80s, 90s. There was the Brady litigation, and that stands out because I think it was one of the few non-architecturally based designations, Four Seasons. Mm-hmm. Again, because it, as I recall, it was an interior. Mm-hmm. We had, I'm trying to recall if this was actually litigation or not, but we had a few enforcement-related issues. Mm-hmm. In various ways, the RKO Keiths in Flushing stand out in many respects. It has a rather unfortunate history. Probably Virginia, one of the first, I think this, they wound up being called demolition by neglect, but this one was an actual illegal teardown in Flushing, where after the fact, we pursued it and basically got a substantial penalty that was inured to the benefit of local art organization. But there were several, and this is a more recent past, affirmative cases seeking to preserve or compel owners to maintain their structures, and those were challenging. On the defensive end, a matter that came back, I'm trying to think, it's a housing development on the Upper East Side, and the name escapes
First
me.
Avenue Estate?
Something like that, yes. And I think after, when I retired, soon thereafter, there was I think they came back in sort of hardship and whatever, so I don't know what came of that, but the original challenge was a significant one. Did you remember?
That's a
research?
Good list, yes. Your recall is terrific.
Word only so.
Yeah.
Okay.
A few that I have found that it's my understanding had some connection with your time at the Law Division. There was a case involving Public School 64.
Yes.
Near Tompkins Square.
Right.
East 9th Street.
Right.
There was the Windermere case. You mentioned, that was
I forget that was a lot. My involvement with that building goes back to the 70s.
Yeah.
When, and I forgot the Landmarks piece of it but that was later. I was originally involved because of the harassment that was taking place against the SRO tenants and our attempt to deal with that. And then the attempt by the owner to have the buildings department vacated. So there was, it was protracted litigation over many years with many issues, landmarks being one of the later ones.
Yeah, for someone, for the benefit of those listening to the interview later, could you explain just generally what an SRO building is and what the landlord or property owner is trying to do and why?
Right. An SRO standing for single room occupancy. There is no formal definition, but it typically describes a building which could have been a hotel and was converted to long-term occupancy, but not necessarily. So maybe basically consisting of single rooms occupied by single individuals. It may have been more popular housing in years past, but more recently, housing that was occupied by poor people. In this particular instance, as was the case in other buildings during a heated real estate market, and the desire to develop sites, property owners would try to buy out, force out tenants, and that is what we believed was going on there. It was a large site, a potentially very lucrative site, and the landlord, well, without going into details of what was going on, it was conduct that we believed was illegal conduct, and took action. And the landlord not only resisted that, but also tried to convince the city that the building was in such a state of disrepair that it was unsafe. And while it needed work, we did not believe at that point that that was the case. And we had a series of federal state cases with the owner, who eventually sold it to a foreign individual who basically let the building stand there for years and did nothing with it, until, I guess, around 2000. I've losing track of time here. And then that's when Virginia got involved. And in the interim, the community pressed for its consideration as a landmark, and indeed it finally was landmark. When the new owner, or a potential new owner, wanted to fix it up, deal with the existing tenants in the right way, he now had to deal with the landmarks piece of it. And that's, I think, the litigation that Virginia was involved in most recently.
Yeah. And I understand that that case, or the city's involvement, resulted in a court order that required repairs to the apartment building.
Yes.
You also mentioned a minute ago a case on the Upper East Side. It's, I believe, known as the First Avenue Estate case. I think the caption is Stahl Development Partners.
Yeah, nothing, otherwise not Eastern something in suburban.
Oh, it's Suburban Homes.
Yes,
there were two. Yeah, in fact, I think they're two landmarked
components
housing projects that were built for workforce housing on the Upper East Side, of which First Avenue Estate was one.
Okay.
That is the subject of ongoing litigation.
Right, I believe so.
There was it was an interesting case where there was a designation. The property was de-designated. Designation was reinstated, but in that period, the owner of the building took off architectural details from a portion of the building, and yet Landmarks went ahead and designated it, notwithstanding the damage that the property owner had done.
Which is one of the issues that came, I believe you mentioned PS 64, where that property owner too tried to change the dynamics by removing some of the architectural features.
Yeah. I also came across issues related to the Manufacturers Trust Company. 510 Fifth Avenue. There was it's a modernist kind of glass faced.
There was something on the interior, I believe.
Yeah,
that could be seen from the outside.
Right. So there was a proposal to cut new doorways into the Fifth Avenue facade of this, you know, kind of great glass facade. And one of the distinctive innovative features of the building is that if you're standing on the street, you can actually look up and see every floor within this kind of glass container. And the result, also part of the proposal was to remove these escalators that are visible and to reduce this vault wall. And
I believe that was only settled.
Yeah. So what I found was that the city had filed a motion to dismiss after, I think, the Vernado Realty Trust filed a lawsuit. And again, there were some issues about disregard of the restrictions that were intended to protect the interior of the space.
Right.
And that building stands today.
Right.
Also came across a couple of news clips about cottages at Far Rockaway.
Yeah.
Does that ring a bell?
That was, and I don't say this necessarily in a denigrating way, but that, I believe, was one individual.
Yes, you're right.
Who, on his own, and I believe throughout was proceeding pro se, was trying to compel the city in many forums to preserve certain aspects of his community.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did he pursue it with, and I, quite honestly, I don't recall Landmarks being involved, but he also sued the federal government because of I forgot the name of the federal property there, but feeling that was not, they were not adhering to their obligations in that regard.
Yeah, it was, my research showed that there were 7 lawsuits that this individual filed. He formed a group called the Beachside Bungalow Preservation Association of Far Rockaway. These lawsuits were, at least 7 of the lawsuits were filed against the city of New York. And there were allegations of noncompliance with the Federal Coastal Act.
That's what it was.
And you're correct. To my knowledge, there was no Landmark hook. And that this is the city successfully defended itself in those lawsuits. Also, I came across your involvement with the South Street Seaport. Do you remember any of your work there?
I know that there was a proposed high-rise development, and I think I mentioned Robin Binder.
Yeah.
I believe that she worked on that particular litigation. But I have, and I had a whole host of issues concerning street vending there, but that's not why we're here.
No, that's okay.
but I don't remember otherwise Landmark issues with the seaport itself.
Yeah. So there was the lawsuit involved that released one lawsuit I'm thinking of involving the South Street Seaport.
Yeah, right.
Your division successfully defended a developer's challenge to the constitutionality of a zoning amendment, which downzoned most of the South Street Historic District, so to preserve the existing scale, human scale, and historical context. And the project that prompted the lawsuit was a 43-story residential tower. It was known as 250 Water Street, and that was a city win.
Right.
But you mentioned Robin Binder.
She might be able to help you more with that, yes.
Find out more about that.
Yeah.
Also, I'm not sure if you were directly involved in this, but do you recall any work that you may have done defending the Landmarks Commission's decision to deny the condominium board's proposal to remove artwork that was attached to the facade of a condo building? Does that ring a bell?
Oh, we're talking about Houston Street?
Could be. Virginia mentioned a Houston Street issue.
Right. There was a work of art facing north on Houston Street and in dispute as to whether its removal required the approval of the Landmarks Commission. I believe it wound up in federal court. And if that's the case I'm thinking mm-hmm. of, then it would have been Virginia again
yeah.
from the Judge Batts.
Okay.
I don't know that we were successful on that.
Okay.
And I think there ultimately was a compromise with the commission,
yeah.
and I think there was a reduced version
okay.
that was agreed to.
Okay, thank you. Can explore that
yeah.
later. Do you recall any work involving a building in a Skidmore house? This was a Greek Revival structure. It was allowed to fall into disrepair by its owners. Mm-hmm. It's my understanding this is the first time, well, a case was brought, this is the first time that a court ordered the immediate remedial measures to restore
right.
the historic building. Was that a case you worked on directly?
It was handled in the division. Mm-hmm. You yeah. know, I remember the initial effort to do that. I mean, one of the frustrating aspects of my job was the limited ability to enforce the law. Mm-hmm. And that was not only a function of resources, although that was a part of it, but also the lack of teeth in the Landmarks law.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, when we first started, the penalties that were available for violating commission action of designations were relatively small and typically could be absorbed as a cost of doing business.
Mm-hmm.
The one effective tool would have been an injunction action,
mm-hmm.
which was a very labor-intensive undertaking.
Mm-hmm.
And resources being what they were, not that many were bought. Skidmore mm-hmm. House was probably, may have been the first, if not mm-hmm. one of the first, and some have been bought since then, but it's mm-hmm. it's not a particularly gratifying way to go about it. In some instances, you find yourself dealing with absentee owners without resources
mm-hmm.
to deal with the situation. People who inherited the property and really don't want to have any, some of them mm-hmm. are, I think one of them was in Hawaii, and you know, trying to deal with a person like that. So that was a frustrating mm-hmm. aspect of it.
Yeah. If they're, again, given your perspective involved in, that you developed litigating or these cases, mm-hmm. either for the city or, well, defending the city, if there were a change that you could propose to the Landmarks law, holding political considerations aside, what would be a way to strengthen it?
Well, I think the problem probably is less the law than resources
mm-hmm.
to implement and enforce it. You could have the best law in the world, and I'm not saying necessarily is or isn't,
yeah.
but without the ability to follow up,
mm-hmm.
then it's meaningless. So that one of the things I know the commission, I believe, still has to deal with, and one of the things that was dealt with in litigation, was the mountain, I don't know if it's a mountain, but a significant number of buildings that it is counted for consideration but not yet acted upon.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that is, to a large part, a resource issue.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily only reason, but there's just so much they can deal with. It's a board of volunteers, I think they are, and this is not their full-time job. So that becomes a problem. It mm-hmm. becomes a problem from the community's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
They have certain expectations, and from an enforcement, and the property owner's perspective, and an enforcement perspective. So I think that's that. And again, I understand there are many other priorities in the city,
mm-hmm.
but that, I think, is a significant area for improvement to make the work of the commission more mm-hmm. meaningful and effective.
And that can be achieved through greater funding, additional staffing. And I appreciate how you mentioned that a lack of enforcement resources can affect community perception. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Well,
and how do you, I guess, how do you view the landmarks law as being perceived by the public in New York?
I don't think there's one view. I think it depends on who's looking. But I think from everybody's point of view, to simply go through the formalities of designating and then not being able to take action with respect to those who ignore the designation sends a message to those who support the landmarks law, as well as those who don't necessarily support it in terms of what they can and cannot get away with. So I think everybody proceeds with a certain assumption that when a law or an action is taken, it will be adhered to and enforced. Once they see that that's not the case, then everybody's approach and attitude changes.
It weakens the rule of law.
Yes. But, and again,
or rather, a lack of enforcement weakens the rule of law.
And it makes those who support it disheartened, cynical, however you want to characterize it. And it makes, those who take issue with the designation feel that they can proceed as they will without concern for the designation.
It almost provides a way to exploit the weakness in the law to the extent that it's not enforced.
And it's not brain surgery. It's not, it's common sense assessment of the way people react to the situation.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Are we doing okay in terms of time? Would you like any water?
I'm fine.
Okay,
no,
we will take a short break in about 10 minutes.
And, I'm okay.
Get some water.
I'm good.
Just wanted to check. Okay. One case that I have not mentioned that I would say is a part of your litigation portfolio or preservation law portfolio would be the St. Bartholomew's Episcopal Church.
And that was one of the cases that I mentioned predates us. I'm aware of it.
Okay.
But it predates my division and my involvement
with
the landmarks cases.
Okay. Thank you.
We addressed issues concerning the designation of religious institutions in subsequent years.
Okay.
And to a large extent, that was not even in litigation, but in response to proposed legislation and how to best deal and respond to that. So that was, I remember, extensive involvement with Dorothy Minor and indeed, City Hall as to how to, there were several proposals, including those, I believe, generally to preclude the commission's ability to designate religious institutions, which never passed, but it was close.
Do you recall using the St. Bart's case, and by the St. Bart's case, I'm referring to the court opinion that addressed the takings issue and the free exercise issues raised by the church? Do you recall ever asserting that?
I do not have that specific recollection.
No, thank you for clarifying that. Did you ever work with someone named Sinclair Armstrong?
Does not ring a bell.
Okay. Did you ever work on any of the litigation that Virginia Waters told me about involving the Broadway theaters? I think there was a lawsuit brought by the Schubert Organization. What do you recall
And it was brought by a former corporation counsel.
Okay.
Alan Schwartz had been Koch's first corporation counsel, and he represented the Schuberts in that litigation.
Oh, that's interesting. So he was the corporation counsel he was Leonard Koerner's boss.
Yes.
When the Penn Central case was argued before the Supreme Court.
Yes. He just came in just before.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's this great anecdote where about Alan Schwartz arriving at the Supreme Court and asking Leonard Koerner for his notes, to review his notes, and Leonard wrote on a piece of paper, "Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court."
I have seen Len argue several times, and he amazes me every time.
Yeah.
He's just, the expression, smooth as butter. I mean, he's just excellent. But yes, I wasn't there for that, but I've heard that story too.
Yeah.
Alan Schwartz was the corporation counsel during the first 4 years of the Koch administration, and it wasn't immediately after, but pretty soon thereafter, we had the Broadway theater litigation, and he represented the Schubert organization.
I did not know that. Thank you for telling me that. We've touched on Grand Central a couple of times. Is it correct that you were not yet working for the city when Penn Central was argued?
In the Supreme Court, I was.
You were working, okay.
Because it was argued in 77?
Yes.
Somewhere around there.
Decision came out in 78.
Right, so, and I started in 74.
74,
but
okay.
It was not on my radar, as it were, because I was not involved with it below, and indeed it wasn't, those cases were not in my division at the time.
Okay. Do you happen to remember anything about the victory when the case was in, the decision was announced?
Not really. I'm sure I was generally aware of it, but I have no specific memory of it.
But as you said, it wasn't part of your division's work.
Exactly.
One question that I didn't ask you earlier, we were talking about what drew you to law, was once you were in law school, did you have a focus in law school, if you could call it that?
I went to a law school that didn't necessarily accommodate that. It was,
as most don't,
right,
or did not. Or.
My job search generally was public sector. Mm-hmm. I kind of knew that's what I thought I wanted to do. When I first started working for the city, I didn't see that as a career.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going. I thought it was. I had heard, and I suspect it was true then and true now, that it's a great place to get experience, but I wasn't focused on making it a career to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
It evolved over years that I was really liked what I was doing and kept on doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what area of the law I was going to be working in, no, not really. And indeed, when I joined the law department, there were a dozen some out divisions I could have been assigned to, and it was the luck of the draw that I wound up where I was.
Yeah.
People were not hired as they are now for specific divisions. They were hired for the agency.
Right.
And in fact, when I joined, I took a civil service test, and I came in through civil service.
Okay.
So it was not that focused.
Yeah. Was your first job with the city?
Yes.
Okay.
First legal job.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, there's often a perception that lawyers immediately focus on one area of the law, but some do.
Right.
But
among my responsibilities over the years was I had to conduct interviews, for potential hire, and I know that not everybody was necessarily being forthcoming with me, but for the most part, people came into it with a pretty open mind.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, I was not, there were things I didn't want to do, but I was less clear about what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. Do you remember, back to some of the work that you did while working for the city, the city litigated many administrative law cases, which, even though they may not have been directly concerned with landmarks, have potential implications for preservation. Among these are Clear Channel Outdoor versus City of New York.
Mm-hmm.
This was a case which challenged billboard restrictions. Mm-hmm. Do you remember anything about
that was more recent. Yeah, and there are aspects of the billboard litigation that are still going on.
Yeah.
It was a series of challenges to the zoning provisions governing the city's regulation of outdoor advertising.
And as you say, it's ongoing.
It's ongoing in the sense that the city prevailed in defending the constitutionality of the zoning restrictions, and there's now litigation involving individual mm-hmm. billboards and whether they were grandfathered or not. Mm-hmm. I think there are less constitutional and more traditional administrative issues involved.
Okay. I think I've recalled the name of the artwork case we were talking about in the condo building. Mm-hmm. There was an artist named Forrest Myers.
Red Myers?
I have Forrest.
Yeah, I know, Myers. but he had a nickname. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Or last name of Myers.
Yes, exactly.
And the address was 599 Broadway, and there was a ruling where the judge ruled that the city would have to compensate the property owner mm-hmm. for reinstallation of the artwork on the landmarked building, but that the city eventually settled
with the owner. That was my recollection.
As you recall, and Virginia discussed that, mm-hmm. Discussed that case as well.
And interestingly, as I recall, the artist was very much on the scene in terms of litigation and mm-hmm. consideration of what should or should not be done with the artwork.
Yeah. What about the case of Parkview Associates versus the City of New York, mm-hmm. in which this is just my paraphrase, but this was a case where the city was able to mm-hmm. get a developer to agree to dismantle part of a tower that had been
stories.
Built. On the basis of an erroneously issued permit. Can you tell me a little bit about that case?
I was literally involved from the beginning in that one, where it was a member of the local community who was actively involved in land use issues and was intimately familiar with the zoning restrictions in her neighborhood, noted that a building that was in the process of being erected was too tall under the zoning resolution, and filed a complaint with the buildings department, and they confirmed that was the case. Mm-hmm. But there was a permit issued authorizing that. And the problem was that the zoning map and the line indicated on the zoning map, there arguably, and the developers believe be the case, was inaccurate. Mm-hmm. And there was some ambiguity in that respect. But the buildings department, based upon the fact that the permit did not conform with the zoning as enacted with the legislation that was in effect, revoked the permit. And that revocation was challenged mm-hmm. to the State Court of Appeals, which sustained the revocation. There was subsequent attempt to get a variance mm-hmm. to authorize on a hardship basis, and that was denied in further litigation, and that denial was sustained. And ultimately, those 12 stories were removed. Mm-hmm. The building wasn't completely constructed. It was the superstructure that mm-hmm. was up throughout all of this.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall approximately where this building is located?
It's on the Upper East Side.
Okay.
I don't remember exactly. The reported decision would have it. I don't remember.
Yeah, okay. And that resulted in a reported decision. Can you think of any other cases that you think are significant for the future of the landmarks law that we haven't discussed?
Well, there is one pending right now involving Grand Central. It postdates me, but the owner of the building is challenging a rezoning of the district claiming that it diminished the value of the air rights to the point of, I have read the complaint.
I think it's a, there may be a spot zoning challenge.
There's a spot zoning challenge, but it's a taking, several constitutional challenges. Yeah. It's in federal court, and it is in the process of being litigated. I don't know exactly where it's at, but but that, not only for the symbolic aspect of the fact that it involves the terminal, but, you know, if maybe a vehicle for the Supreme Court to revisit some of the matters that, some of the issues that people think or thought that were resolved. Who knows?
Yeah. Gabe, why don't we take a 5-minute break?
Sure.
And we'll start right back up.
Okay.
Okay, Gabe, we're back on the record after our short break. I wanted to clarify a question I asked earlier about the St. Bartholomew Church litigation. The St. Bart's opinion that we often talk about, which was cited in 1991, was represented a number of things, but certainly established the precedent in New York City and elsewhere that the Landmarks Commission did have the authority to limit the ability of St. Bartholomew's Church its proposal to build a tower, an office tower on property that it owned next to its next to its sanctuary.
Right.
And among the claims that were raised in that lawsuit, there was a takings challenge that the city successfully defended, as well as a free exercise challenge that the city ultimately successfully defended. You mentioned to me that you were not directly involved in this case. Do you recall the name of an attorney or attorneys who likely handled the case directly?
Right. I believe it would have been John Pines, who's now the deputy chief in our general litigation division, in the law department's general litigation division. he, for quite a few years, was handling cases related to the very issue of the First Amendment intersection with the Landmarks Law, and I think under that context was probably the one handling that.
Okay. And to your knowledge, he's still working with the city?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for that. You've mentioned, wanted to change or shift gears now to look at some of your working relationships during your time in the city's law division. You mentioned that you worked often with Dorothy Minor. Do you recall other working relationships with the Landmarks Preservation Commission during your tenure?
Well, clearly Dorothy was the first and foremost, but there were others and in the commission who I recall interacting, although I don't remember the specifics of those interactions. One was Lenore Norman, who had been, I believe, the executive director. That stands out. We had occasional interactions, depending on the issue, with some of the chairs, Gene Norman. I remember, and I'm sure there were others, but
Do you remember any particular anecdotes about your time working with Dorothy Minor on any particular cases?
Well, Dorothy Minor, in fact, the law department has an annual awards event, and one of the awards that it gives is to outside agency counsel. And that award is named for Dorothy Minor.
Oh, fantastic.
When it was established, and basically it was the sense of not only myself, but others who worked with her, that she epitomized the ideal outside general, not outside counsel, but general agency general counsel. She was committed. She was bright. She was knowledgeable. Cooperative, all the traits you would want in an agency council.
In any of the cases you recall working on, did you happen to ever come in contact with any members of the, let's just say, the Preservation Bar that represented the Municipal Arts Society and the New York Landmarks Conservancy? Lawyers like Ralph Menapace or Paul Byard?
Well, Ralph Menapace, I know of. I think Virginia may have had dealings with him, Virginia Waters. I don't believe I had personal deals with him. I believe the Art Society has an internship. That's not
a Menapace Fellow.
Menapace Fellow, that's right. And I believe one of the early ones subsequently became a lawyer who worked for the law department, John Lobier. And I think he had some interactions with us. Another attorney who I know is very active with the Municipal Art Society, who I've interacted with to some extent on landmarks issue, but more on other land use related issues, is Michael Gruen. Mm-hmm. He wasn't an employee. I think he was active in the society. I don't believe he worked for it. And of course, the land use attorneys who, from time to time, represented these groups.
Do you really recall anyone by name?
Who represented the, well, I remember the land use attorneys over the years who...
Do you know Al Butzel?
I know
Alfred
him.
Butzel.
Sure. That's more recent, I think, okay. I believe, than in the past. Mm-hmm. Jeff Braun as representative developers. There were several attorneys who tended to represent community groups in various issues, mm-hmm. land use related and mm-hmm. landmarks.
Okay. Do you recall observing any changes within the Landmarks Commission through the years in terms of how the commission may have changed as a new chairperson took over?
I think that in years past, the commission had periods where it was more active. Mm-hmm. In its designations. I mean, I think that again, there's a certain logic to that because mm-hmm. it started off with a clean slate and having addressed many in situations, many buildings and communities, while the pool keeps on evolving and developing, the pace is not necessarily the same. So I think in years past, in large part a function of the chairs, but I also other considerations, I think the commission was more active than it perhaps is now.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that preservation advocates have been a factor in the city's legal strategies over the years in terms of administration of the landmarks law?
To some extent. Part of that is reactive, not necessarily proactive. But clearly there were instances where the advocates had a point of view with respect to the law that the commission and we disagreed with. Mm-hmm. Those tended to be more procedural than substantive. Mm-hmm. But we were not always in agreement. We were more often than not were in mm-hmm. agreement, but not always.
Do you recall meeting with any of New York's preservation advocacy organizations over time, or did they tend to deal directly with the Landmarks Commission's attorneys?
I think clearly most of the interaction, would be with the commission. There may have been one or two meetings that I attended, but that would have been rare.
Okay. If I'm correct, you've worked under five or six mayors? Could you listen?
Five. Well, I was a baby, but A. Beam was my first mayor. Ed Koch. David Dinkins.
Okay.
Giuliani. And Bloomberg.
Okay. So that is five.
Yes, it is.
Can you comment on their different attitudes about historic preservation?
Well,
are there any who stand out as being?
A Beam didn't impress me one way or the other in that regard. I was a junior attorney and just had no occasion to to get a sense of that. And I think for the most part, my assessment is not so much the people, but rather the people they appointed, because I did not have that frequent interaction with the mayors in my job. I did it on occasion, but I quite honestly don't recall having any landmark-related interaction with the mayors. But in terms of the commissioners they appointed, I believe Ed Koch was very supportive. And he hired some very competent, proactive people in that regard. I think the same can be said for David Dinkins, although I don't think that he was there that long to have that large. I mean, he was there for a full term, but not that much of an imprint on it. I think Giuliani pulled in the reins a little bit. And I think his commission has reflected that. And I think Bloomberg was supportive. I think, you know, there was, if you will, a new day again with the commission once Bloomberg came in.
Do you think it's fair to say that Mayor Koch could be viewed as the strongest mayor in terms of historic preservation law?
I'm reluctant to say strongest. I think it may be the case because he had the predisposition to support it, but also the circumstances were that such that he had the opportunity to do it.
He was mayor for 12 years, right?
Well, but so was Bloomberg.
Okay.
But he was mayor during the beginning, if you will, of the commission's work, and a lot happened. By the time Bloomberg came, there was a lot to be done, but not to the scale, I believe, that those first 12 years.
Do you see a difference in how the city approaches the administration of the landmarks law today compared to the 80s or 90s?
I think it's less confrontational. I mean, that probably is the most significant difference.
And do you attribute that to the fact that you mentioned earlier that the commission tends to work more proactively with property owners now on the front end of a designation issue?
I think that's one factor.
Okay.
I think another factor is that there are property owners who, having had the city having had the experience that it's had with the landmarks law, all the evils that were feared and contemplated have not taken place, so those fears are somewhat addressed. I think the commission has on its own made changes that made the process more friendly to property owners. Again, I don't mean that in a pejorative way, I mean just more user-friendly for property owners in their interaction with the commission, and I think all of that helps. So I think all those changes are near to the benefit of the law and the work of the commission.
Have you seen the attitudes of judges and lawyers change towards preservation and landmarks? I know in my own experience, there's sometimes a lack of knowledge about preservation law,
right?
For example.
Well, a couple of things. Most of the activity, litigation activity, I think, was in New York County, in Manhattan. So those judges tend to see more, and they became more educated relatively quickly. And indeed, the hostility that has been encountered, and I think probably still exists to some extent, are in those counties, those boroughs of the city where there's less familiarity among generally as well as among the judiciary. And that may, again, be a function of history as well as cultural value, civic values in those boroughs.
Yeah, that judicial education aspect to what you just described was something, an observation shared by Virginia Waters as well.
Early on in the early years, I think I'm telling tales out of school, it was pretty much a foregone conclusion that Landmarks was not going to succeed in Queens in its efforts to landmark. The whole scheme of things had the Board of Estimate overseeing, the then Board of Estimate, ruled on constitution since then, but it reviewed decisions of the Landmarks Commission, and the Board of Estimate consisted of the five borough presidents, mayor, controller, and the city council speaker, and essentially individual land use decisions, when they came before the Board of Estimate, for the most part, the borough president had the up or down vote, and the others followed. And it was generally understood that when it came to Queens, things were not going to pass because Donald Mattis at the time. So I think that reflected the frame of the thinking, and that was, what is it now, 30-some-odd years ago. But while that's changed, and there are many districts and buildings designated in Queens, I think there are still some remnants of that, not only in Queens, but in some of the other boroughs.
Yeah, Staten Island among
them. Staten Island being among them right now. I think more Staten Island now than Queens, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever, I guess, collected any archives of your own related to your preservation law casework?
Not really, no.
No? And if you had, would it be with the city? Or did you maintain sort of files?
To a point, I maintained files, and they are where they are. Yeah. And once the computer came in, just about everything that I had was there.
Yeah.
As opposed to hard paper. Things were.
Yeah.
That's a way to bomb.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about why preservation law is often singled out as being, difficult or negative in a way that other land use laws are not, like zoning?
I think preservation law, although it contemplates the preservation of broad areas and districts, the common perception continues to be that it's individual buildings that are the subject of the landmarks law. And that is true to a point, but clearly I don't believe to an extent that people perceive it to be. And I think that as a result, people feel picked upon and people sympathize with the notion of being Picticon. Why is this one individual bearing the societal burden? Mm-hmm. And it's an argument we've seen in litigation, but I think it reflects a common perception that government is, again, picking upon individual property owners, and there's a sense of unfairness about that, as well as this country's commitment to property rights.
Is there something that preservation groups could do better to help ameliorate that perception?
I think the effort has been made to educate with respect to the societal benefits. I don't know how that could be done better, but that's the message that needs to get out there, that society as a whole benefits, and to some extent to address the concerns that the property owners whose properties have been landmarks are being picked upon or are somehow bearing an undue burden. Clearly, education would help. I don't know that I have the ability to describe an effective educational campaign in that respect, but that's I think the way to deal with the popular perceptions.
Would or could I guess municipalities generally perhaps do a better job at making incentives available, financial incentives available to owners of landmarked properties, tax abatements, historic rehabilitation loans, tax credits, transfer development rights programs.
Well, some of that exists.
Some of it exists. But it's not necessarily widely used or widespread.
Right. none of that, that would be great, but none of that comes without consequence in terms of the resources the cities need to run. And clearly that would help. But trying to keep a balanced view of things.
Yep.
I can see that people would see how that hurts also.
Do you think that preservation law in New York City is headed in the right direction?
I think so. I'm not aware of any significant stumbles, if you will. I'm not aware of anything that's dramatically threatened or that the city is about to lose any significant resource. So in that respect,
If you were giving advice to young lawyers coming out of law school or interested in working on preservation-related cases, is there any particular advice you could give them about how to pursue work in the preservation field?
Well, the opportunities are few. In the sense that, let me rephrase that, the opportunities to make a living at it are few. I suspect that there are always going to be people who are involved who would be happy to receive pro bono assistance, but it's either with government, with some of the better endowed advocacy groups, or with property owners. With respect to the property owners, I don't know that they would necessarily focus on someone whose main aim is to deal with landmark issues. I think they have multiple issues, so I don't know if that's the place to go. And even if you come to work for government, unless you're working for the commission, which has, I believe, two attorneys working for it, those opportunities are not as focused. So I think you need to be prepared to deal with a broader spectrum of issues, they could be related issues, and be it with government. I realize my focus is the city, and I'm not quite sure how this plays out in other jurisdictions, but working for government is probably the best opportunity, and pro bono work would be the other.
Last question, sort of a big one. I know that you've received a number of awards through your career, but there was one in particular that stood out to me that was given to you from the American Bar Association, which was a government service award. And one of the things that was striking to me was that you were not only involved in preservation-related cases, but had done groundbreaking work in the city on issues involving public health, the calorie law in New York City among them, the health department's help guiding the health department's response to the HIV/AIDS crisis, First Amendment rights, quality of life issues, including installation of GPS systems and credit card processors. A lot of work during your career has made living in places like New York City easier and more pleasant. And I don't know, is there any kind of common thread that you can find through the work that you've done that helps knit these different areas together?
Well, clearly that was the aspect of the job that I loved and missed the most, is dealing with matters that make a difference, that made a difference. And I don't know too many opportunities that one encounters in a lifetime to do that. The land use cases clearly affected communities as a whole. I don't, you know, some of the issues that I was more intimately involved with on a personal level were the use of the streets, the street vending, the parades, the newsstands, the sidewalk kiosks, and the like. None of them is necessarily in itself dramatically important case to the overall city. It may significantly affect individuals, but as a whole, it affects the fabric of the city. And while you don't think about that on a day-to-day basis, every once in a while you step back and really appreciate that is satisfying and gratifying work.
And do you see preservation as a
absolutely
part of contributing to that fabric?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And an important part of it. You know, and perhaps more important where we are right now as opposed to where I live, which is, you know, Eastern Queens, which is less amenable to those kind of hitless, although there are historic elements there, less amenable to those historic considerations.
Final question to you, and it's hard given your incredible track record as a lawyer, but if you were to pick a maybe proudest moment in terms of preservation law, what would that be?
In terms of preservation law? I ask you to pause there while I think. I think that, and this may be a function of who I am rather than anything else, but making sure that there's a fair process in place, as opposed to talking on one particular action or decision, but from an overall perspective, every once in a while there were challenges or issues that came up dealing with the process, and concerns came up about, if you will, the fairness of that process. And I think the integrity, the overall integrity at the end of the day, can only be maintained if there's a general understanding and agreement that everybody's been given a fair shake, mm-hmm. and procedural issues are important, and I believe that to the extent that I had I did have some role in that, I think it's important to the continued viability of the commission that people appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate your time today, and I've certainly learned a lot from you.
Thank you, and good luck with the project.
Thank you so much.
Very good. Thank you.